Okay. I'm happy to introduce our speaker for our seventh watch. Let me read his bio to you. This is Fabian Munroz. Fabian is an associate professor of computer science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Prior to joining UNC, he was an associate professor at Johns Hopkins and a founding member of the Johns Hopkins Information Security Institute. From 1999 to 2002, he was a member of the technical staff at Bell Labs, Lucent Technologies. He's received several awards, including National Science Foundation Career Award 2006, always good, and a Best Paper Award at a flagship security conferences, including IEEE Security and Privacy and the USENIX Security Symposium. He got his PhD and master's from the Kron Institute of Mathematical Science in New York University.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here and see so many familiar faces, some longtime friends, and that's good to see. And today what I'm going to try to do is recap some of the work we've done over the last 5 years and try and take it from the a higher level perspective that you would normally see at an academic conference talk, in the sense that I'll try and give you the intuition behind the approach we took and some of the reasons why, I don't want to say attacks, but the information disclosures we discovered are possible. Okay, so this talk is entitled Hooked on Phonics. The strange symbols in the title will be explained to you a little bit later. And the run-in title here is Learning to Read Encrypted VoIP Conversations, I should say VoIP Sessions. So this seems a little bit odd at first. I'm going to try to read something that's encrypted. And in particular, I'm interested in VoIP conversations. So first thing is white VoIP. See if this works. Wipe. Wipe, wipe. Maybe not. All right. So as we all know, VoIP is increasingly popular as a replacement for traditional telephony. And in most cases, I think probably everybody in the room has used a VoIP system in the past, right? So I probably wouldn't spend too much time there. But several analysts predict that the subscriber base for this will top 225 million subscribers by 2013. And some of the reasons for this is obvious. Cost is one. As a case in point, this little-known school just north of where I am last month announced that they had completed their transition to voice over IP. So the entire system has moved to voice over IP. And they believe they will save something like $2.7 million annually by this transition. So, of course, not to be outdone, UNC said we'll do the same, and I'm on the board trying to see what we're going to do. All right? So there's the cost savings. VoIP, you get all the benefits that you get with traditional landlines, right? In particular, you also get some benefits that we might not necessarily have with landlines. So, for example, you can get email transcriptions of your voicemail, right? And the subscriber base really took off when we turned the corner, allowing you to use your existing phone number landline and use it as VoIP, right? So we're all attached to our phone number. We didn't want to give that up, but now with VoIP you can do that. You can have make 911 calls for some of the systems. You can use VoIP on your mobile phones, on your laptop. We all use it. It's great. So I think what's driving the subscriber adoption, though, from the client, from the user's perspective, is that we have many free online services, right? So we have Skype. I'll get back to Skype in a second, which is great. And a lot of these services are remarkably reliable, right, and relatively easy to use. So you've used Yahoo Messenger, Google Talk, Fring, and Skype, right? They're relatively easy to use. My mom uses Skype, so, you know. This is my metric, right? My mom can use that. We have no problems making even video conference calls. It works just great. And, you know, as a case in point on the, you know, the fact that these things are reliable and relatively easy to use, I think a few months ago Skype announced that they get something like 65 million online users every day. They've made more than 300 million video calls every day, and something like 30 million Skype to landline and mobile phone calls every day, right? A lot of people use this stuff. So from the security perspective, though, I think the security and privacy implications of VoIP are still not well understood. And in particular, the majority of the attention in the security community really focused on the call setup phase for voice. So let me explain what that is. So if you think of making a VoIP call at a high level, you know, if I'm trying to call Farnham, I have to figure out where Farnham is. So I might use something which is called the session initiation protocol to try and do this discovery to figure out where Farnham is, right? And so you make these connections, and it might be connections to what's called a SIG proxy, and we're trying to locate where Farnham is. In the case of something proprietary like Skype, this might be over a peer-to-peer network, okay? But once I have done the discovery, then you have this connection between the two devices, okay? And from a privacy perspective, this you know, this connection will be encrypted, right? And it's using something like the real-time transfer protocol, or SRTP, which is a secure version of the real-time transfer protocol. Okay? So all the attention in the last 5, maybe 8 years really focused on what's called caller ID spoofing, registration hijacking, or denial of service attacks that all focus on the call setup phases, and particularly the lack of authenticity and integrity checks in the SIP protocol, okay? And which allows you to do things like what's now called SPIT, which is spam over IP telephony, okay? We are interested in something different. So, and in particular, to explain what's going on, let's take a higher look at what's happening with VoIP. In VoIP, there are two channels. There's the voice channel and the control channel. In all the work, the prior attacks that focus on the control channel, failings in the control channel, right? We are really interested in the privacy of the voice channel, okay? So after this communication is set up, I'm interested in the privacy of the voice channel. Right? The calls are encrypted, so you have an expectation of privacy, right? At least I do, right? And so that's what we're focusing on. So for us, we were looking at examining the feasibility of eavesdropping on encrypted calls after they have been legitimately established. And by that, I don't mean there's this so-called person-in-the-middle, man-in-the-middle attack, right? You have a legitimate call set up, and we're trying to figure out what can you do then, okay? So I have to give credit to Whitfield Diffie and Susan Landau for their book. This image comes from Privacy on the Line, which focuses on, which I think is an excellent title for this work, they focus on the conundrum we face with wiretapping laws that they are today, right? So we are in this middle here, and we consider this is an encrypted conversation, and we're curious, and we want to know, hey, what can we learn? This should sound like a brain-dead idea, right? Why would I do this? This is an encrypted conversation. This is nuts. So I'm nuts, and I have to have some followers who are nuts as well. So I need to give them some credit. So over the years, we've had a few people work with me on this. This started, and you'll see the transition, and there's going to be a test about that so later on. Whilst I was at Hopkins, Charles Wright led this work. This was part of his thesis work. Charles Wright is now at MIT Lincoln Labs with collaborators Lucas Ballard, who's at Google, and Scott Kuhl, who's at Red Jack, which is somewhere in this area. And then some of you might realize, of course, that I left Hopkins and I moved to UNC. And at UNC, I had replaced this with three new guys. It's a much bigger team, as we'll see as we continue. Andrew White, Austin Matthews, and Kevin Snow. Austin will come back up in this presentation a few times, and if you note here, he is at CMU. He is at CMU, one of my mistakes, but we'll come back to that during the talk. Okay? So let's see, I'll give you more perspective. Okay, so you're thinking, let's think of it this way. So we're looking at the voice channel, and this is encrypted for confidentiality. So if I'm wearing my attacker's hat, we have this. Hey, you have to give me kudos for this, right, this slide. Right? You have the attacker sitting here, and we're looking at packets on the wire, right? And so what normally happens, you have a voice signal, and the voice signal is going to go through some codec, and we'll talk about what that codec does, so typically compression, and it's going to use a real-time transfer protocol here. So encryption is going to happen here, and it's going to send this over the network, right? And so you get these, and usually about 20 milliseconds of audio is compressed in one frame and sent as a packet along the wire. So we're sitting right here and we see these packets and we're asking, hey, what can we do? Okay? So let's take a look at this information leakage, why it happens. So we as designers overlooked, we think, two important design decisions, which happens over and over again. This shouldn't be new. This is the standard trade-off that we play. One is the move towards variable bitrate encoders, right? So you can think of these as they compress different sounds at different fidelity, okay? And we do this for efficiency, right? It's very efficient, right? So we move towards variable bitrate encoders. And the codec that we use in all our experiments is something called the Speaks codec, which is an example of what's called a code-excited linear prediction codec. Speaks in particular uses 9 different bit rates in what's called narrowband mode, so 8 kilohertz, and 21 bit rates in wideband mode. Okay, I forgot exactly how many. There's this ultra-band mode similar to what Skype does, but more bit rates than that, more fidelity. Okay, so we have compression on one end, and when we have encryption, we use what's called length-preserving stream ciphers. Okay, so it's for efficiency, right? We have the packet. This is a real-time conversation, right? So we can't buffer stuff. And for encryption, we're just going to encrypt the packet and send it along its way. Okay? So we have this interplay. And why is this interplay important? Because there has this has this unintended interaction. So on your right, you have a high-level view of this. So you have the signal is compressed, and then the compressed signal is encrypted. But you notice that if I were looking at the encrypted packets on the wire, the packets reflect properties of the input signal. Okay, let's look at a closer example here. So here is an audio waveform. Here is the output on from the codec, so bitrate on the y-axis and timer. And here is the output off the wire, so if you're looking on the wire. And so the y-axis is in the packet size in bytes. So something should jump out at you. The last two plots there is a significant striking similarity between the last two, right? So we want to go backwards, right? This is what the work is about, okay? So, okay, so let's put more context. So where do you think this combination of variable bitrate encoding and stream ciphers is supported? Well, I found out last week that Siri, you guys all know about Siri, actually uses Speaks, the same codec that we use, right? And it's fascinating. When you use Siri, your entire utterance is sent back to a server, right? So your voice is residing on some server somewhere. In their case, it's sent over a HTTPS connection. Yahoo Messenger, Microsoft Communicator, they all use support VBR and stream preserving ciphers. Google Talk is the same. Skype as well. Skype uses is proprietary, so we'll get back to Skype a little later in the presentation. In terms of encryption, it also uses a stream cipher, which is proprietary, so we don't know much about, but though it's believed to be a variant of RC4, another stream cipher. Okay? So there are plenty of these, and the popular software PBXs like Asterisk all support this combination, right? Okay. So it's you should be convinced it's combination is out there. Okay, so how bad is this leakage? Is the question we get all the time. So back in 2007, we showed that, this is Charles Wright, the Hopkins group, that it's significant enough that we can determine the language of the encrypted conversation. So whether this is a phone call in Spanish, French, English, et cetera, okay? And well, later in 2008, we showed that this work we call Spot Me If You Can, we were able to uncover spoken phrases in encrypted voice sessions. So for this, you have to know what you're looking for. Okay, we'll get some intuition about a little bit later. There's a lot of work that has happened since then, several papers that have redone our studies, and quite a few other twists on this, including some work by Backus and al. That showed under different assumptions and under some conditions, they may be able to tell you something about the speaker. So lots have happened since then. Well, this is 2011, almost 2012, and Keith asked me to come here, so something happened between this time and this time, right? And we're going to talk about what happened along the way. Okay. So respect to the, back to the original text, you might argue that this leakage is not a big deal, right? In the first case, the language of the call can be determined in a much simpler way by endpoint analysis. So if I see a call between Mexico and Spain, hey, that's most likely in Spanish. I don't need to do all the stuff that we did here, but not a big deal. And the second attack requires this a priori knowledge, as I said. You have to know what you're looking for. So in our case, this is the example, if we were looking for whether or not the phrase attack at dawn was in there, we'll try and do a search-based technique to find, is it likely that the utterance attack at dawn is in here? to know what you're looking for before, ahead of time. I see Kevin is shaking his head here. He's probably thinking this is not realistic. And we got a lot of that pushback. This is great, but this is not that realistic. From the pure academics, we also got this is not that new either, which is true. Everything has been done before. Trust me, everything has been done before. You will actually see in this presentation. This has all been done before. And there's a really nice piece of work by Kevin McCurley that appeared in one of the crypto conferences where he noted that we have to be careful in this interaction. And in particular, in his paper in 2006, he was saying that in the crypto communities, the communication models that they're using don't really capture the power of the adversary. So he warned about these types of stuff. There's no analysis in like we did for VoIP, et cetera. But he just warned about this combination is something you have to pay attention to. From the industry point of view, Phil Zimmerman, which some of you might know, Phil was the designer of PGP and runs the ZPhone project. He was probably the only looking around one that tried to encourage others to move away from VBR and use non-VBR-based codecs. Right? He said, this might be a problem. Go to non-VBR-based codecs. I wouldn't say that. I think there's a bit of a conflict of interest there. Phil runs his ZPhone project. So that's about it. I'll see you there. But pretty much the reaction from the community was, no, this is not a big deal. Okay. So we go back to the slide. We're late 2008. There was a transition from Hopkins to UNC. But something more important happened around that time. And to assure that my program managers, I was working on this stuff during the transition. And you'll see we were thinking about this problem. So back around 2009, Skype, for the first time, released its codec, dubbed Silk, which is a VBR-based codec. And the IETF also worked to release their specifications for a new codec. Both of these support variable bitrate encoded and stream ciphers. So this happened in about 2009 and it's ongoing. So I assure Carl that since 2008, we've been thinking about this problem. And I went back and during the transition said, actually a lot of discussions with Charles Wright, went back and said, we had some wacky ideas in the beginning. We might need to go back to those wacky ideas. And in particular, what was the work missing, right? So this, all the prior work really did not take advantage of these language-specific constraints that govern a language, right? So these are called the so-called phonotactics of the language, and we'll see more about that. So there's constraints that govern this what are valid transitions or valid combinations in the language. So if any of you played this game, Phonogram Shuffle, it's pretty awful, awesome, I should say, sorry. And you get you get die, which have letters and sounds on them, and you roll them out, and you are trying to make as many legal-sounding words as possible until your opponent challenges you, right? So this is great. Have 7-year-old twins, this was great, right? We can play this, and they can make up words. Of course, they're 7, they don't want to do this anymore, they want to use the app, and there is an app for this, right? So they want to use the app. All right, the missing link really was back to this guy, Austin Matthews. So I was missing, somebody who would go down this dark road with me, and I can say, no, we can do this. And he had actually the right background, and the story here is I was actually teaching an undergraduate class in computer security, and his background was he had double majored in computer science and linguistics with a minor in mathematics. So I said, aha. we can continue in some stuff. So what we did was we started to go back and look at the phonetic models of speech, and that's what this work is about, and I'll tell you, give you a little bit of background. So there, these things are represented by, sound is represented by phonemes, which is this, you can think of this as the individual speech units, and as we know, sound is modeled by this articulatory process, which is governed by how airflow goes through the mouth, nose, and throat, okay? In English, there are about 50 to 60 phonemes. Depends on which aspect you ask. They'll give you a different number how many phonemes there are there. And this is generally represented, the de facto standard for the representation of phonemes is what's called the International Phonetic Alphabet, IPA. And you've all seen IPA before. If you open up a dictionary, next to the word, you'll see the pronunciation have the circle in blue, right? That's IPA. That's how you pronounce the word, okay? That's there. All right. All right, so let's talk about what we did. I'll give you the high level, and then we'll try and go down into intuition for each phase. So remember, we have what we're trying to do. We have this encrypted conversation, and really what we're seeing is these encrypted packets. Okay. What we need to do is first segment this into a series of likely phoning segments, step one. After we've done that, we're going to try to figure out the individual phonemes through a classification problem. Then we will make errors, and this is actually our most challenging step, so we have to do some correction. Once we've done this correction, we go through and we try to figure out where likely word boundaries are. And then once we have these word boundaries, we figure out what the likely words are. Right? So we go from there, and we get our rock and roll down at the bottom. Okay? So I'm going to give you, next several minutes, some intuition behind each one of these steps. Yes, you'll see that in a second. You'll see that in a second. Good. So it turns out that this process that we use here has startling similarities to how infants learn for the first time. Of course, the human brain is fascinated, and we do it substantially better than we are able to do it. But the connections, there are some striking connections. So interesting story here. So when I first started to look at this in 2008, there was work in the computer science community by Blanchard et al. Group. I think Blanchard was at CMU. And it's entitled Modeling the Contributions of Phonotactic Cues for the Problem of Word Segmentation. And this was originally published in a computer science venue. And I spent several months trying to understand this paper, no luck. But we're going to come back to the journal version of the paper, what happened a little bit later, when they needed to write it for a different audience. So this appeared in Journal of Child Language. This is probably one of the best papers I've read in several years. Sorry, Farnham, it's one of these guys' papers. This was really good. All right, so what did they show? So infants use perceptual, social, and linguistic cues to segment streams of sounds, right? Obviously, we only can use linguistic cues. And even more surprising that there's several studies in the social and behavioral sciences that show that they use this low knowledge of well-formedness, right? And they do that, and they learn these rudimentary constraints of the language while simultaneously segmenting words. So you think about it, what we all did when we were growing up, right? In conversational speech, like we're having right now, I'm the only one talking, but in conversational speech, there are no pauses within words and very few pauses within words, right? I speak very fast. So talking to your kids, they have to be able to somehow grasp what are the constraints of the language and learn this over time, which is a fascinating problem, but we all speak our language, so we're able to do that. So this is quite fascinating, but we're going to use this notion of well-formedness. And they use familiar words to help them segment the stream, right? So this paper called Mummy and Me, which talks about how infants use familiar words to help them learn other words. So their name, they will learn, it's shown that they learn new words that are preceded or before or after their name, right? Because we keep saying, my daughter, Kaylee, 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 they'll pick up on that, and then the next word they learn is something that's before it or after it. Eat, sleep, those type of things, right? So they use that knowledge to help them segment, and it's almost like a bootstrapping process, right? Our brains are just fascinated. It does this bootstrapping on the fly. And over time, we're able to build up this vocabulary, and more importantly, we learn the phonotactic constraints of the language, okay? Right. So we want to apply something a little bit similar. From the behavioral sciences literature, which is fascinating, and I've spent a lot of time looking at some of that work, some work by Haley shows that as early as 6 months, infants are able to differentiate within word versus between word sounds. Okay. As a side note, it's pretty scary what this can be used for. There are all these progression charts that you should be able to say, by 2 years, here are the sounds that your kids should be able to know and recognize, right? And you can imagine these being used for a variety of tests, which when I started to look into this, I was kind of freaked out about, right? But if you want to see how your child is progressing, you can go and look at those charts and see where your child should be at a certain age, okay? It's very fascinating stuff. So let's go back to our problem. So what we do, let's look at step one, the phonetic segmentation, and I'll try and address your question as we get there. So we have these series of packets, and we have to map them up into these phoneme sequences. Okay? So the intuition behind this is as follows. So here is a representation of the utterance and official deadline. And here you see the strange-looking symbols is the IPA pronunciation of that, and the frame size on the wire. Okay? And if you'll see that this, the frame size differs in most cases in response to phoneme transitions. And the red numbers, I don't know if you can see this here, it says the number of frames that this phoneme spans. So back to your question. So this one can span four phonemes. Okay? But if you take a look at this, and you'll see that at sharp transitions, like every time we have a phoneme transition, you see this big change for the most part. That's not true in the part of deadline, that circle over there, right? You see that there's no transition. Several phonemes and there's no transition. But for the most part, there's some transitions that happen, and we need to take advantage of that, right? So this is what we're going to be using in this phase, okay? So the idea is we're going to have to try to identify these boundaries using machine learning techniques, and in this case, we use a discriminative machine learning technique. This one is called maximum entropy modeling, which turned out to follow another very similar idea that appeared in the linguistics community in 2008. So there are a lot of similarities there. But we take these contextual features into consideration. In particular, you'll see in the next slide, when we're trying to make a decision on what this could be, we look at the history of decisions we've made, and we also look at what's coming next, right? So you take this contextual stuff into consideration. And so here's the illustration of that. So over here, suppose I'm looking, you see the current frame size. We try to segment this, and what we'll look at, you know, the frame size bigrams on trim primes that we've seen, the sequence of frame sizes we've seen since we made our last boundary decision, and the number of frame sizes we've seen since our last boundary, right? So we can use all these. All these are used as features in this discriminative approach. And this discriminative approach is trying to model all the features that it would take to regenerate examples of that model, okay? It doesn't really care, as you'll see with the other classifiers that we use, to try to differentiate one class from another, okay, which will be discriminative. This is, in some sense, doing something slightly different, okay? All right, so we're going to take advantage of these features, and it's using, you know, we're going to make a decision, but we have to look back what decisions have we made in the past and how many frames have we seen, because through training we know that, you know, seeing a sequence that's 15, 16 frames and we haven't made a decision, we've messed up somehow, right? So you can use all these. Okay, so the next step would be the phoneme classification step. So now we've segmented this. I have to try and do a classification on what these likely phonemes are in here. So more intuition for this, you can think of, let's take a look at this utterance here, intelligence. And this is a heat map of several speakers, in this case, a few tens of speakers saying the same utterance, intelligent. And on this heat map, the darker the region means the more overlap. Okay, so what you're basically seeing here is like the TE in intelligence, you can see that's been a very dark, right? So at a high level, you can see that you can think of these different utterances having a signature in some sense that you can use, right? Obviously, a phrase can be encoded in many different ways, so you have to deal with that, right? And this is what we took advantage of in the Spot Me If You Can, the earlier paper, where we were essentially saying, okay, if you know what you're looking for, we can look at generate different ways to try and say that and then turn this into a search problem and see whether or not we see that in the stream, okay? But this is the intuition behind what we're going to use for phoneme classifications, because you can see different phonemes are encoded at different bit rates, going back to the variable bit rate encoding part of this, okay? So for this, we use what's called an ensemble learning technique. So it uses a generative approach, which is just a standard profile hidden Markov models. And the idea here is you're going to try and model a sequence of things. Okay, this is widely used in the biological sequence analysis literature and speech community. And we also use a discriminative approach, which is very similar to what I told you before, right? You're trying to see what are the best set of features you can use to regenerate models, examples from that model. Okay, so a little more intuition. So in this case, we're making a decision on what's the likely phoneme that's here. We're going to, you know, make a decision, but we're going to look and see, you know, what's the frequency of popular bigrams, what other bigrams that we see around it, right? So in this case, we were looking at the set of phonemes, and you can see in the set of phonemes we realize, well, these two would have circled here in green. These observed trigrams was frequently observed when I'm looking at the phoneme, let's say, N, right? So we can say, ah, this is most likely what we see for N, right? So we have to be making these decisions. These are also based on modeling, statistical modeling from a large training set, which we'll talk about a little bit later, on the popular bigrams and trigrams. So you can get an idea of when this utterance, this phoneme is usually said, what's the likely what's the sequence you see on the wire, okay? We make lots of mistakes here. This is a very difficult problem. So we have to apply some language model correction to this, and you'll see a little bit more about this. And the idea is you can rule out things that are impossible, okay? And we'll see some of the constraints that we use from, again, the linguistic literature here, all right? So that's step two. I'm going a little bit fast, but we'll try to recap all of that. Step three is now that we have these corrected phonemes, what are our guess? And now we have to do this word break insertion. We have to say, okay, we just see a string of phonemes. Let's try and decide where their likely word boundaries are within here, right? So we get these word segments. What we do here, we go back and we apply a technique from 1988 by Harrington and Al that it's using to find these word boundaries. And in this case, they're working off the full acoustic signal, right? So they have the luxury of the full acoustic signals, but the ideas apply the same. The first two steps are similar to what Harrington did. And the idea is first you find is insert potential word breaks into impossible phonetic triplets. So as an example, the sound, the ing sound in blessing way is impossible in English, right? So if our guess in the sequence we have this, we can say this is wrong. We'll have to use our next likely guess and correct that, okay? Second case, we resolve invalid beginning and endings, right? So just like I was showing you with the phonogram shuffle, we've learned what are impossible beginnings and endings, right? And so, for example, the sound, the ZDR sound in eavesdrop, this is impossible as a beginning or ending sound in English. In other languages it is, but this sound is impossible in English, right, as a beginning and ending sound. So we can use that to say, aha, this is probably a word boundary here, right? Read the sound is not possible, okay? And so now we're going to split the result in segments that we have using a fast dictionary-based search, right? So in 1998, Harrington didn't have the luxury of the advancements that we've had in optimized search algorithms, so we can apply that as a third step to boost what he showed was possible in 1988, okay? All right, so the last step is we're just trying to find word sequences where the pronunciation matches the segment we're looking at, right? And the idea is pretty simple. We're going to apply these consistent word breaks, and here's an example. So if this input is this IPA string, what does it sound like? Anybody knows IPA? All right. Well, we have two sequences that match in our dictionary for that. So we're looking at sequences of words. The first one is the exciting way, the exciting way. And the second sequence is the ick-citing way, right? Ick is yuck, ick-citing way, right? These are two valid sequences that match the segment we're looking at. So we're just going to use the consistent, and the dot here is a space. Consistent break, so we're going to choose the consistent breaks, which is the two at the end, and we'll choose the exciting way is the one we come up with. This is intuition. Again, we just use this linguistic cues. It's impossible triplets, beginning and endings, just like I showed you that how inference learned. Of course, inference, we all did it way better than we can do with computational linguistics. Okay? So step four, getting to almost the last step here, is the matching phase. Okay? So now I have these word segments, and I have to match it to words. Okay? So this is where Austin came back in again. So what we apply here is we're going to find the closest dictionary pronunciation using an edit distance approach. So edit distance is a technique for seeing the minimum number of transformations you have to take to convert one string to another string. Okay? And so you have insertions, deletions, and substitutions. So in our case, the edits that we're going to make are based on articularity processes. Right? So that's what we designed. It's a new edits acoustic, well, phonetic edit distance approach. Okay? And so I have to give you a little bit more background. All right, so let's think about, we're going to use two things here, vowels and consonants. So if you think of vowels, vowels are characterized by the tongue position and lip shape. Okay? And so there are three things that you use to characterize vowels: the height, which is the height of the tongue, the backness, which is the tip of the tongue forward or backward, and pucker, round and lip pucker, right? So if you say all these words there, say them out loud, you'll feel a difference in your mouth, right? So heed, aid, height, head, and aisle, you'll feel a difference. You see, he's practicing. You feel the difference, right? You can definitely feel the difference, right? So that's that vowels are characterized by these from this perspective. And similarly for consonants, we need to do something similar. There's what's known as place, so where the restriction is made, because consonants are really made by restriction of airflow, the fricatives and the stops, et cetera. So place and manner, so where and how this restriction was made. There's also another insight that you can use, and that's whether what's called voice and whether or not the vocal cords vibrate or not. Right? So these are features that we use to identify consonants and vowels. So what do we do with this? Well, so we're computer scientists, right? So what do? We design a new edit distance-based approach where our edits are based on this articulatory process, right? So we design a Euclidean space, and that Euclidean space, we're basically going to do edit distance. You know, the number of edits is going to take, so if I give you this one sequence and I want to match it to this other sequence over there, how many transformations I need to make to take this from one to the next? And the one with the minimum amount of transformations is the best pronunciation. That's pretty much what we have to do here, right? So, again, we have round and backness and height for vowels and consonants, voice, manner, and place. And so there's cost functions associated with this. So we'll say, you know, it costs you more to make a mistake between a vowel and a consonant than between two vowels, right? Okay? Through this summer, the team expanded with another linguistic student. They're always smiling in the beginning, not necessarily in there. Catherine Shaw, who her pretty much for her REU, she's in the linguistics department, was helping optimize this space, right? So bringing her phonetic background, syllabic constraints, and all that, we're just trying to optimize this space. But everything I've talked about, I will talk about in terms of the results, doesn't involve the optimizations that she did. Okay. So what's a big problem with everything I mentioned so far? Okay. So if you think about homophones, 8 and 8, they sound the same. How are we going to tell the difference? What will you do? What's the first thing you do?
Context,
that's right. So we go back to use a language model correction that uses speech parts of speech tagging. So this is a verb, this is a noun, and we look at triplets and we say, hey, this is invalid. And so we'd use this for correction. This is a standard approach in the speech community. So that's what we use there to help us. Okay. So recap, halfway there, you need to go a little faster. So we have this huge process, right? So we have the phoneme segmentation, the classification with their error correction, segmentation, and word classification. And I should say that for the phoneme segmentation, we do as well as the state of the art where they have the acoustic signal, right? So within 20 frames, so the boundary decision is within one frame, we do as well as they do with the full signal. Phoneme classification is our most difficult part. The accuracy there is about 50% on our first guess. So we actually keep, you know, our top-end guesses. And the language model correction is actually going to go and optimize across all these. So our first guess might be wrong, but we can go all the way down the way to try and figure out what might be the likely thing. Okay, so that's what we do here. All right, so sounds reasonable? Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the evaluation, what we did, and then we'll talk about the community's reaction. All right. So we use what's called the TIMIT, the TIMIT corpus, which is I forgot how many years old this is, but this was an immense effort supported by NIST that collected 600 speech from 630 speakers, 70% male, from 8 dialects of American English, kind of represented it here. The labeling is a bit weird, so you know you see Western doesn't map really well to the map to the areas, but there's Western, North, South Midland, North Midland, Southern, North, New England, and there's also one label Army Brat, which is this guy moving all over, so they're from everywhere, so they just, I think, 22 speakers labeled Army Brat, right? And so that's in the corpus, okay? So we have 10 sentences per speaker, And what's most important about this data set, as I said, it's a fantastic effort by NIST. This data set is used heavily in the speech community for all the benchmarking. Okay, so it has time-aligned word and phonetic transcripts. So we can use this for ground truthers and more importantly, for training. Right. So we have the time-aligned transcripts. So every phoneme is painstakingly marked in this and said, this right here is EN. Right. So we can build our training models on that. Not possible if we didn't have this data set. Okay. So that's what we're going to use. Then we ran into a big problem. And that is, okay, so we're going to go through this process, and we're going to make our guess, which is our hypothesis. And we have ways to filter whether or not we make a guess or not. And we can use our confidence in each one of the stages, say, if our confidence is not above a certain threshold, don't even try, or so we can trade. So, but how do we evaluate the guesses? So here's two sentences, a reference hypothesis, the reference on the top and the hypothesis on the bottom. How would you rate this in terms of adequacy and fluency? She's shaking her head. She doesn't think it's worth a six. It's, you know, is this off? You know, I think if you saw the hypothesis, you might be able to get something about what the reference was, right? So this is an active area of research in machine translation. There are entire conferences dedicated to this subject. So we said, we're not going to reinvent the wheel. Let's try and figure out what we think is a suitable model to use. And we chose what's called the Meteor metric. It's the metric for evaluation of translations with explicit ordering by Levy and Densowski at CMU. Get the connection? At CMU, I stupidly convinced Austin that he should not stay where I am for a PhD and should go elsewhere. So he went to work with Levy. So I lost Austin. He's gone. So we use this this scoring engine, okay? And what we really liked about Meteor is that there was extensive evaluations on the parameter sets that show that, in fact, their scores match those of human judges. And even the caveat here is even human judges really can't agree on what score to give something. Okay, so here's some examples. So this scheme is not perfect, but it's an automated way for us to test what we're doing. Okay, and there are plenty of other choices. NIST has something called Blur. There are many different things we could have used here. Okay, so the scoring is really based at a high level on something called precision and recall. So this is just scoring the proportion of matching words in the reference, which is called recall, to the proportion of matching words in the hypothesis, so how well you do this precision. And in particular, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, that metric will penalize based on long runs, right? So, and the idea is the longer the run you have, the more fluent something is. So if you have a lot of mistakes, then this is not really good, okay? So here's some examples. So here on your right would be a reference, and on the left would be a hypothesis. So Cliff was soothed by the luxurious massage. And the only thing that's off here is okay? And it gets a score of 0.8. We'll get back to this in a second. Here's another one. Just to try to show you why this is really difficult. So it's not easy to create eliminating examples, right? So red is exactly where you're off. Yellow is because it captures stemming, right? So if I stem those two, this is correct, okay? And that gets a score of 0.53. And something shorter, like that's your headache, and the reference is that's your headache, which I think is pretty good, right? We'll get a really low score, right? Because, again, you penalize in for areas, and the shorter things are, the penalty is going to pay off, right? This is a really active area, but we still like this approach, and we've been using this for scoring. The good thing is Levy and Densowski also give us a way to interpret the scores, which is even better than anything else, right? And based on all the analysis they've done and how well this match up to human judges. And so all you need to think about is they say scores above 0.5 are considered understandable, and above 0.7 is good and fluent. This matches up with what I think here. The caveat is even something with a low score could still be understandable. Right, but you certainly get above 0.5, and this is understandable. Okay, now I have to remind you the results you're going to see. We're in an encrypted context, so this shouldn't happen at all. Okay, just remember that. All right. So what are our adversarial assumptions? We're going to say we can see the sequence of packet sizes. Yep, each packet is contained in a single frame. We'll get back to this later. So you take the frame, 20 milliseconds. That's a packet sent on its way. Okay. We have knowledge of those spoken language. Like I said, you can use endpoint analysis, whatever you want. And we have a large corpus to train on, like Timid, right? I can do that. Okay. So we did a series of experiments. I'll give you a flavor of two of them. One is called the what we call the context-dependent results. And in Timid, there are two sentences denoted SA1 and SA2. And these sentences are said once each per speaker. Okay? So we're going to use these for training and testing, make sure we don't overlap. But essentially, this is a case where you have some context of somebody saying this, just not the speaker you're trying to that you evaluate. Okay? And so here are some of our reconstructions. So she had your dark suit and greasy wash water all year. So I'll warn you that Timid, the sentences are constructed to be phonetically rich. So these are tongue twisters, right? But here are our reconstructions. Good? Relatively okay. This for SA1, and for SA2, don't ask me to carry an oily rag like that. I wouldn't tell you what some of our guesses were. Don't ask me to carry. A lot of things came up here, but you see, for the most part, we're doing pretty well. Okay, this I believe was the results for the New England dialect, and across the board, where in New England I think dark and that are pronounced almost the same way, so we were fine. Right, across the board, we really didn't see any differences, so nothing here. Okay, so that was the context-dependent case. The more realistic case is the context-independent case, right? So here. We use all of Timid's sentences except those SA1 and SA2, which we just used for training. So you can imagine that now you don't have anything about this particular sentence, right? You've seen pieces of it in different contexts. So this is obviously a much harder case. Remember, we're trying to reconstruct everything backwards. And here are some of our scores. So the reference is at the top, and the hypothesis is at the bottom, right? So you can see artificial intelligence is for real. We got artificial intelligence is carry-all. It does carry-all. It's good. Bitter unreasoning jealousy, bitter unreasoning dignity. We got parts of it, right? So, again, this is supposed to be encrypted. So you shouldn't be able to get any of this. Okay, that's the point here. Okay. And across the board, we actually show that we do worse than we did before. Right? You see by the box plots, we do worse. But we realize that we all can also do something else because at each phase, we have a notion of how confident we are in our guess in each one of the steps. Right? So if we're not too confident, what we could do was essentially instead maybe report something like this, only where we're sure. The problem is I have no idea how to score this, so we don't know. But I think something like this even still leaks information, right? So we'll only utter something, I'll put our guess, if we're sure about it, okay? All right, so let's go back to what happened in the community and some mitigation. So back in 2008, there were some obvious reaction to this, and some of which we evaluated in our work. So one is, why don't you just pad up to the multiple of the block size, right? So, go from 64 bits to 128 bits, et cetera. Just pad up to the multiples of the block size. And we show that you have to go so far out before the attack is not successful that it's not worth it. In fact, at that point, you might just use constant bitrate encoders, right? And it's a better solution. But constant bitrate encoders, again, we're losing it straight off on efficiency, right? And in the backbone networks, this would be huge overhead. So 2009, remember, Skype came out with their codec Silk, and they do something different. So I can dynamically insert multiple frames per packet based on network conditions. So remember, we have this assumption along is one packet, one frame per packet. And if that's gone, stage one of our process segmentation takes a huge blow, right? We don't know how to deal with that. So I think, there's a lot of discussion, and lots of in the security community and context, what would you do instead? And these guys already have something that they do. So we ran off to try to figure out, hey, when does this kick in? Are we completely hosed? And this is a good strategy. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into the details here, but the gist of this is that we could never get this to come into effect. We had real Skype clients. And essentially what you're looking for in this bottom graph is it shows the number of packets we're seeing on the wire as we turn a knob, which is the amount of packet loss we put in the network. Okay? And what you see is that point where it jumps down, is trying to stuff now more packets, more frames into a packet, so we see less packets on the wire. But that happens at something like 20% loss. Right? So we said, okay, maybe it's not packet loss, it's latency. And across the board, we really didn't see any change. This jump down, the lower number of packets happens at some latency that's so far out there, you might as well just, you know, call your buddy over a tin can, right? So I'm still at loss as to when this comes into play. So if somebody here knows, let's talk to me, right? But stuff in multiple pack frames per packet is definitely a countermeasure to this type of things, okay? All right, so quick highlights. All right, so remember these guys were not happy in the beginning. They're a little bit happier here. Since then, they won several awards, the Best Paper Award at IEEE Security and Privacy Symposium, and just recently found out they won the AT&T Best Applied Security Paper for 2011. So they got their cash, and they're happy. They didn't even buy me drinks, but that's okay. They have their cash. What has also happened so the reaction now was quite different than the reaction before. Remember when you said you had to know what you're looking for in advance? And in particular, there are a number of news stories about this. So the Register had this thing, New Scientist. There were all these everyone called us linguists or computer linguists or computational linguists. We are not, right? But they had these strange titles like should have used pheromones instead. I don't know what that meant. All right. So we had a lot, and we'll see what this leads up to in a second. And then this another story ran, which I jumped back, and this is actually perfect because I thought it was Kevin in the picture, and he's wearing blue here, and it looked, so this story ran about Skype conversations can be eavesdropped, and then we started getting a lot of phone calls, and we can talk later about what was the context of some of these phone calls. Some of them Carl Landwehr sent my way, but on these phone calls, we got a lot of hypothetical scenarios. Anybody wants to guess what they would be? Can we apply this to what would be this hypothetical scenario, you think? What's that?
Listening in on
Al-Qaeda. Yeah, hypothetically, can we apply this to, say, Arabic? We'll get some of these questions and some other things I can tell you about later. So there was a lot of this that took us, off kilter for a while. But more importantly, I think on a positive note, there are new RFCs released, so RFC 6366, which discusses requirements for new internet audio codecs. And these internet audio codecs are trying to do everything. I mean, when ITF does something, it's by committee, so they jump, everything gets in there, right? But at least there's a lot of discussion within that RFC about recommending the availability of CBR codecs, which is okay, but really designs of new VoIP schemes. So this is ongoing discussion. And this has actually been pretty positive for us, our group, because it's led to a lot of ongoing dialogue with other groups. And my hope and my goal is to rethink this from redesigning the codex from scratch, right? So if I'm wearing my security hat and not just the efficiency hat, right, and I want to pay attention to this privacy concern, what might we do in redesigning these codecs? Okay? And so that's where my interests really lie. So I don't think I have to explain it to this crowd that the cybersecurity community usually works by breaking it and fixing it and breaking it and fixing it cycle. That's the type of work I find interest in, and that has motivated a lot of this. So we don't want to only show that there's a problem. We want to try and show how we can help fix this problem. So a lot of the work we've been doing now, and actually this is taken on a life of its own, because I think the real solutions here, as we'll see in the end, come with interactions beyond just computer science. Okay. All right, so let me summarize. So clearly, VoIP is here to stay, right? It's not going away. We'll all love it. But again, I think the security and privacy issues are not well understood, and they should not be overlooked. We still need to spend a lot more time thinking about what can go wrong there. And for us, I think the quality of the reconstructed transcript is far better than we would have expected. And this, as I said, is only likely to improve with more advancements in computational linguistics, which I'm not a computational linguist. But we've started to work very closely with the linguistics department at the UNC, so much so that we have a weekly meeting trying to explore this space a little more. And I think it's actually this mesh reminds me more, I think I was telling one of you earlier that this reminds me of my days as a Bell Labs. I loved Bell Labs, right, where you really did multidisciplinary work. There were no barriers. So this reminds me of Bell Labs, right? And so I think we've been more excited about that than anything over the last couple of years. So I think in closing, this really calls for to do this well, stronger interdisciplinary partnerships that bring principles across multiple fields. We can't do this alone. We can all learn from each other. I've learned a tremendous amount from going through the linguistic, the social and behavioral sciences literature that the students would come in and I would say, this is the best paper I've seen in a long time. And they'll say, oh, another one of those. Do we have to read it? Yep, you got to read this one, right? So I think this is where the real creativity will come from, and I hope that we can spend some more time here. And with that, I close, and I'm done and ready for any questions. Thank you.
Really fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've done a little work with our teachers, and when I ran across in talking to them is that things that were bugs to me were features to them.
That's
and
right.
Vice versa. For example, I was looking at figuring out if a speech thing was a bunch of segments glued together that I could see whether someone was trying to fake out my system. And they viewed smoothing as a necessary thing, so they got rid of all the things that made it possible to recognize whether text was looked at. Have you run into things like that when you're in the post-disciplinary work where people, what you saw as smoothing, they thought that?
In a number of ways. So for one, if you give them a sequence, you can't even agree what that sequence is. So that's the tough part, right? And that's just the nature of the beast, right? So if, as an example, for the phoneme the segmentation, so just identifying where the phoneme boundaries are is very difficult, even looking at the audio, so the raw segment, right? So this is a very difficult part. And so as you said, they make all these enhancements, like you need to do smoothing here, et cetera, and those really are, you know, they have no effect on the what we hear, right? But for the types of analysis that we type of do, even these small changes mean a lot. So what it has led us to is now, so in all these cases, you can think of us using the codec as almost a black box, semi-black, a gray box, and has now led us to go say, let's use this as a white box, fully understand the constraints here, right? And what are some of these changes that are made? What are some of these adaptations that you're talking about? And how best we can take advantage of that, too, in our understanding of the problem space, right? But we have a lot of meetings where we go back and we say, well, this doesn't make sense that we only use this number of bit rates, right? And they say, no, this is perfect sense because some of these, some of these other sounds we can easily reproduce even given this lower bit rate. So it's a waste of time to do anything at a higher fidelity, right? So there's a lot of this back and forth. And it really means, I think for the first couple of months, we were both on the terminology was different, so that was really hard. But once we focused into a specific task, the problem became a lot easier. So what we end up doing actually is abstract this away from VoIP altogether. So this is the interactions with the linguistic community is about phoneme reconstruction that has no real application in mind at this point, right? We're saying, other than their application was interested, and they said this was interesting from the point of view for drug names. And if you say drug names on the wire and you want to make sure that there's no confusion in what that drug name sounds like to something else, this can help in that context, right? So we've been using this as a driving example, and I'm trying to move them as far away as VoIP from possible because half of the meetings will be stuck explaining something that is happening on the IP side. So it's trying to find this balance where, specifics are removed. Yep. Anybody else?
Why
So let's see. So the 20 milliseconds depends on the mode. So say if it's a narrow band mode, so you'll see every 20 milliseconds of audio, it will be one frame, and that one frame will be one packet, right? So even as we saw from some of these graphs, the phonemes might span multiple frames. So far we've had no problems at different, so at ultra-band, wide-band, or narrow-band, where we're talking things on the order of about 50 milliseconds. Okay, so there's a lot of variability in there, and we haven't run into any problems yet. But that's because we have one frame per packet. What really messes with the proper is if we stuff multiple frames per packet, right? So it's still, even if you're looking at 50 milliseconds, they're trying to just look at this as one frame and then stuff it in. So no problems there yet, but.
But clearly, if you add 10 seconds worth of speech.
We're host.
Host.
Yeah, we're host. That's for sure. So the difficulty there from the real world is this is a real-time protocol, so you don't want to do any buffering, right? And so maybe that's why some of the Skype enhancements don't kick in. Just don't know. I know I'm between you and lunch, so I think we're done. We're good. Yep, you have one more?
I have a simple question. My basic assumption there is incorrect. But either in the case of more generally, isn't it people who
So if this was not a, so remember they have this, the stream, the problem here is this, the use of a stream cipher. There are other ciphers modes we can use. The use of a stream cipher is still leaking information about the content, right? So if we had the luxury, for example, of using a block cipher, that would not be the case, right? No matter, you know, how many resources you throw at this, you shouldn't be able to do this, right? So it's this. So you do have this expectation of privacy, even if you use in VoIP, right? So that's why the conversation is encrypted. But we're going to use, for efficiency, we're going to do something that's real time, right? Just take, imagine you just see something, stuff it in an envelope, you don't change the size of the envelope and send it, right? There are other ways on the spectrum, right? Stuff it in an envelope, but that envelope is always the same size no matter what, and then the problem goes away, right? So it's not that the crypto in no way, shape, or form is broken. It's the fact that the mode of operation you use here leaks a lot of information, right? So
I think the key point, though, is that 10 or 15 only you couldn't afford to encrypt the whole stream.
Yep, yeah, that's right.
Computationally, then your argument would be true.
Now you can.
Yeah. So
yeah, and the take for the stream cipher like RC4, this is very efficient, right? So you can encrypt the packets and send them all this way. There's, you know, in terms of computational resources, that's not a hurdle anymore. I can do this on my phone. Yeah. All right. Yes, Carl?
So from the policy side, you think you can get rid of Khalil on this thing?
So I was having this discussion with Susan Landau, who visited a few weeks ago. I think my response is that Kalia is a can of worms that I don't want to open.
But if this works, you don't answer.
That's right. Yeah. It's a double-edged sword, though. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.